Hey everyone, feels like we're recording a lot of bonus content these days, but
my wife.
If it's something came up, and Will's already blown the lead here, but something came up that felt too pressing, too urgent, too topical for us to pass up today. I'm referring, of course, to the new Borat film, which I guess you saw a few days ago. You'd seen it, actually, when we recorded our last episode, and we're positively vibrating, just undulating with desire to get your thoughts on the new Borat on mic. I had not seen it yet, but I did watch it this weekend on Amazon Prime, of all things, maybe like one of two things I've ever watched on Amazon Prime, which I certainly never signed up for and somehow have anyway, but then also certain things you have to pay for. Don't really understand how Amazon Prime works.
I think people should illegally download the movie, but then send a $5 bill in an envelope to Jeff Bezos to support art and artists.
Anyway, we had to talk about this, right? I mean, obviously we had to talk about it. Will's already done a blog post about this on his blog, willsloanask.wordpress.com.
I talked to the editor and they were into the idea, so they gave me free rein.
They didn't edit it like normal. They didn't absolutely gut your prose.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, let's get right into it here. I mean, I think we're flying fast and loose today. I think we're not going to treat this like a regular episode.
I just have a question for you to begin with. I know you watched it. Is it thumbs up or thumbs down for you? Did you like it?
Yeah, I liked it. It's a thumbs up. I mean, it is, it's very funny. And part of my thought process here, undeniably, I think, is that sequels of this kind in this day and age are almost always bad and not funny. Like, sequels have a tendency, as we, I feel like, ceaselessly complain on this show, they have a tendency to be fan fiction.
Or it's just the same jokes over again, like Dumb and Dumber 2 or something like
that.
Right,
exactly. Or like the third Austin Powers movie. Like, every movie made today is just Goldmember. Right? Like, everything is like, remember this joke from the thing that you like 20 years ago or 10 years ago or whatever? Well, here it is, you know, and our get out of jail card is like, we're going to add a sort of layer of meta irony to it so that we're, you know, it's actually self-aware and we're going to wink at you or something, but it's not really, it's just lazy. So, I mean, I'm not inclined to be cynical about Sacha Baron Cohen. You know, I admire his work. I think he's a funny guy. But, I mean, I think I was somewhat primed to expect something like that. And that's not what we got. I mean, this is very funny. It somehow kind of uses the same devices as the original Borat film, and obviously the same character, though it adds a new character who we'll talk about who's very good as well. But it manages to do all that and, you know, feel like a Borat film, but also feel like something new and something something funny. So I liked it. How about you?
I liked it too. I laughed a lot, laughed all the way through it, which, you know, has to count for something for a comedy. We talk a lot on this podcast about bad liberal comedy, and I felt that there was something missing from Borat 2 that I couldn't quite put my finger on. And I think the problem is that it's a good liberal comedy. It's not a left-wing comedy. So there's a lot about the film that I admire. I think it, the hallmarks of bad liberal comedy are that it's not, is that
it's not funny,
not funny, tends towards the maudlin, veers away from sort of systemic analysis of the situation. I'm saying this very pretentiously as if every comedy has to be written by fucking Thomas Frank or something, but.
Well, I would just add to that a few kind of friendly amendments, friendly additions. I think another hallmark of liberal comedy, a hallmark of liberal political comedy specifically, is that it's actually not very political, right?
Right. The Rally to Restore Sanity is the definitive example of bad liberal comedy, but also I think Jon Stewart's recent film Irresistible, which every lefty podcast has talked about at this
right.
point.
Right. In fact, we got a ton of mileage out of that, and I wrote an essay about it.
That's a perfect example because, you know, it's a deeply ideological movie that is nevertheless insistent that ideology is not real, or if it is real, it's bad, and it's the thing that's wrong. And it continues Jon Stewart's kind of career-long thesis that, well, we're all basically the same, we all basically agree on everything, and then politics comes in and fucks everything up.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's certainly relevant here, and you allude to it in your blog post, but actually that's not quite what I meant by liberal comedy having a sort of anti-political side. I meant something a little cruder and more basic than that. which is that if you watch SNL or something, let's go for low-hanging fruit. You sure. know, let's say Alec Baldwin's awful Trump impression on SNL. There's no real political content. There's no political satire being directed at Trump because so much of liberal comedy, just like liberal politics itself, it is fundamentally credulous towards institutions and it believes in institutions. It believes in the office of the president. And so it's funny to just have somebody playing the president and lampooning the president, just doing exaggerated, you know, facial expressions and whatever. Like, that's funny. It's the same way that, you know, my working theory about Andy Borowitz and why particularly older people seem to, I mean, I know this is a caricature, but really seems to me like a lot of people's parents, let's say, find Andy Borowitz very funny. To me, Andy Borowitz is worse than SNL. I mean, just the worst of the worst of the worst. But my working theory about it, why certain people find it funny, is because some people find the idea of lampooning the news format inherently funny, right? Mm-hmm. The news is something serious and somber, and the reporter voice is something serious and somber. And so when Andy Borowitz does one of his, you know, fucking lazy phoned in headlines, it's like, Donald Trump to Kim Jong-un, what's your secret? You know, they think that's hilarious. And I mostly only see the Borowitz headlines, but, you know, Borowitz does actually write whole articles that accompany these things. And just to further my theory a bit, I can imagine people like reading the whole body text of a Borowitz article, and it's just the same joke over and over again, but it adopts the form of a news article or a news report. So it's like, sources close to the Pentagon said that Trump made the remarks on a call, you know, and it's like, it's not funny at all, but it has a particular form. And so the idea that, like, right, this is a serious thing, but it's not real. That's inherently very funny to people. And I think you see that. This is my long-winded friendly amendment, by the way. That's something that you see, I think, throughout liberal comedy in the Trump era. And mercifully, I don't think that's a critique you can really level at the new Borat film.
Now, if I can refer to SNL one more time and then hopefully never again, because it is very low-hanging fruit at this point. But one of the lowest points of liberal comedy of the last 4 years was Pete Davidson and did a joke about Dan Crenshaw a couple years ago, a kind of mean joke about his eye patch or something. And that was, I guess, controversial in some circles. And then the next week, they invited Dan Crenshaw to come on the Weekend Update, and he sat there with Pete Davidson, and they like shook hands, and Dan Crenshaw gave a little speech about how we all need to listen to each other in these divided times.
Right. This is the comedy equivalent of like when Henry Louis Gates was arrested by that cop while trying to just get into his own house in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in a peak Obama era thing, Obama had them both come and have coffee at the White House or something.
So what I admire about Borat 2 is it is an angry film. It's a confrontational film, and it has no time for any of those kind of platitudes about, can't we all just get along? Aren't we all the same?
It's got no time for propriety either, which is another thing that's a staple of liberal comedy, right?
In fact, as my friend David Haynes pointed out to me, it's a movie that really sees civility as the enemy. I mean, Sacha Baron Cohen's movies are all about civility, Trojan horsing in.
Chauvinism, bigotry, prejudice.
Racism, sexism, yeah. Etc. I admire that this is a movie where he defines enemies, he identifies enemies, and he targets them. And nowhere is this more apparent than in the Rudy Giuliani scene, which I've seen some debate about. I've seen some debate about, even among liberals, about, is this fair? Was he actually doing what he was depicted as doing?
I mean, okay, well, to the second one, yes, he was clearly doing. I mean,
Who are you going to believe, him or your lying eyes?
He frequently touches, you know, the woman he believes to be the reporter,
yes,
who in the movie is Borat's daughter, who's 15 in the movie. She's a 24-year-old actress in real life. But, I mean, he frequently touches her in a very sexual way. And I'm sorry, no amount of editing selectively or whatever can paper over the fact that Rudy Giuliani sat down with this young woman for an interview. And then within a few minutes, I mean, possibly an hour, who knows, went into a bedroom with her and just like thought he was going to fuck her. I mean,
yeah. And I feel like these debates about like selective editing or what have you, that people are sort of trained to have when a Michael Moore movie comes out don't really apply to Borat, because this isn't...
Well, it's
this,
performance art. I mean,
yeah, it has no pretense of being journalism. It has no pretense of objectivity. And further, it has no pretense of being fair to Rudy Giuliani. The movie is saying this is a terrible man. He's a despicable man. He's complicit in evil, and he will never be brought to justice. So the best that we can do right now is to humiliate him in front of the world. And I respect that. I think that's a very admirable impulse.
Giuliani's defense, by the way, is that he was tucking in his shirt, which is hilarious. Yeah.
So I think if I have an issue with the movie, it's that I think Sacha Baron Cohen's worldview and his methodology has remained more or less unchanged since 2006. As everybody has said with regards to this movie, the world is in some ways similar and in some ways different from 2006. When the first one came out, everyone was saying, oh, it exposes the dark side of America. It exposes the racism that we keep under wraps. You know, all that's changed is that the racism is marching in the streets now. But that poses a very critical challenge to Cohen's project. I think he's funny throughout, but I think the reason why this movie doesn't take it to the next level, why the movie is still something of an echo of the first movie rather than a progression of it, is that he doesn't really adapt to the times. He looks at the world around us and he says, this is a real problem. I don't know why this is, but we got to vote him out. That's the thesis.
Yeah, get a load of these people. Now, there's something you alluded to in your blog post, which I actually didn't notice, but does it actually say at the end of the film, go and vote?
Yeah, it says now vote. That's the text at the end of the movie.
I completely missed that, but I was annoyed to read that, and I was kind of hoping that you were making that up or something, because that makes the movie so much less funny, like just on an abstract level, that it's trying to be like topical, and it's like, oh yeah, if you don't vote, these guys win or something. I mean, can't we just laugh, please?
It's interesting coming at the end of a movie that is an apocalyptic vision of America. It is unrelentingly bleak. It's an America of plastic surgery, of debutante balls, of pro-life or anti-abortion doctors, of QAnon conspiracy theorists, of anti-mask rallies, one hideous sight after another, and the movie's prescription for it at the end. I mean, I admire the bleakness of the film's vision, but the prescription for it at the end is to vote. And I get the sense that Cohen regards all of this as primarily a Republican problem. Because early in the film, Borat sees Jeffrey Epstein on TV. He sees a little clip, stock footage of Donald Trump hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein. And I mean, as we know, Jeffrey Epstein's a bipartisan problem. But Cohen regards him as a Republican problem.
Yeah, there are no red states and blue states. There's just the flight logs. That's the only thing that really brings red and blue America together. Yeah, I just want to say as a caveat before I vigorously agree with you, it's worth reiterating, this film is very funny. I mean, I approve of it. I approve of this movie. But I think Will is exactly right in that, you know, if you look at the focus of Cohen's ire here, journey back for a second to kind of the spiritual homeland of this show, the mid, the early 2000s, kind of 2004, 2005, 2006. Borat came out in 2006, the original. This was a time where, as we've talked about a lot, your principal nemesis, if you were, you know, a Daily Show watching, George Bush hating, I had George Bush on, he was on the bullseye on my dartboard, I'm not making that up. I had a deck of cards, which I think I've posted on the Patreon, where it's like slanted to the right, it's like Bush cards slanted to the right even more for his second term or whatever. If those were your politics, right, what are your who are the antagonists in politics for you? It's red states, it's Bible Belt conservatism, right? It's perhaps if you were, you know, inclined to be a sort of Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins type person, if those were your guys, it was just religious belief at all. Chris Hedges had that very popular book, The Other Chris H, American Fascists, right, which was all about kind of evangelical Christians. Those were the antagonists. And in a big way, I mean, I think one of the things that sort of united all of those different threads of kind of Bush era liberalism, and it's incredible how much this mirrors the liberalism of the Trump era when you really think about it. What united all those threads was kind of a belief that problems were caused by ignorance, the ignorance of individual people. You know, there are certain parts of the country that are just inherently more reactionary. And that's why the United States is the way it is, which is why when Obama came along, It was like, well, this is all we need to just negate all of this. It's like an erudite constitutional law professor who's charismatic, seems to be well-meaning. He's got a lovely family. He's the first black president in history. It's, you know, it's this is the negation of all evil, which is how I think most of us kind of experienced it in our more credulous moments back in 2008. So that's the, you know, that's the liberalism of the Bush era. And jump ahead to Borat's subsequent movie film and the liberalism of today. All the film really does in some ways is update the same thesis for the Trump era. And so much of the liberalism of the Trump era has really just reinvented that original thesis, except now it comes under different guises, right? So we don't hear as much about the evangelicals. I mean, the evangelicals are in many ways Trump's most reliable constituency, but that's not, if you're a liberal and you have kind of your finger on the pulse of liberal discourse, they aren't your main antagonists anymore. Ignorance is still the main antagonist and cultural reaction, but that's centered on other things. That's centered on online misinformation, whether that's Russian bots or QAnon or whatever. I'm very interested in QAnon and phenomena like that. I do think online misinformation is a problem, but as I've written a number of times, I think that the liberal insistence that the facts are how we defeat this, like we need a fact-based approach to politics. First of all, misunderstands political identity and political belief. You can't defeat a reactionary political identity by correcting it with facts. But secondly, I don't think that things like Facebook and Twitter, whatever, I don't think ultimately these are responsible for things like QAnon. I mean, I think they're the conduits through which certain features of late capitalist society kind of express themselves, but the conditions that enable things like QAnon are structural in nature. And so to go back to the film, I mean, I think Will's right that in many ways, all Cohen has done here is kind of taken the same sort of red state thesis from the original Borat and transplanted it into the Trump era with all its kind of assumptions and I think misconceptions about, you know, the sources of these problems.
I think what you're saying really manifests itself in one of the movie's less successful strands, which is when Borat quarantines during the pandemic with those two kind of far-right conspiracy theorist guys. It's a scene that seems to have a lot of promise, but it doesn't quite take it to the next level. There's a part where they're telling him about crazy conspiracy theories that they believe, that Hillary Clinton drinks the blood of babies.
I laughed at that part.
Well, you know, it's funny, though, but I remember seeing that bit with the frat boys and the first Borat in a theater, and there was kind of an electric charge in the theater at that moment because it felt like, I can't believe these people are saying this on screen. I can't believe this thing that everybody knows that people like this believe but don't say. They're actually saying it. Nowadays, we're obviously very immersed in QAnon discourse, and so it's not quite enough. It doesn't have the same shock to hear somebody just say it. It's funny, sure, but there's not enough shock. And to take it to the next level, I think Cohen would have to really reckon with the fact that it takes a broken political system, not just the Republican Party and its kind of media apparatus, but a complete failure of the system to nourish something like this and let it go anywhere close to the mainstream.
Yeah, that's right. And just as further evidence for what I just said, in one part of the scene, you can see that they're looking at some website that's called like Patriot News or something, and that, you know, that's where they get their QAnon shit, their shit about the deep state, the Clintons drink blood, yada yada yada. There's a better version of this film where it does all or almost all of the same stuff, but then it's twice as long, and he's also going around to like blue states and, you know, metropolitan areas and doing the same thing with, like, you know, he's punking Chuck Schumer as well.
By the way, did you ever see the episode of his TV show, Who is America, the one where he interviews Bernie Sanders? And he interviews Bernie Sanders in character as kind of like a real red state, you know, online ignorant idiot. And they're talking about healthcare, and Cohen's character is saying, you know, ridiculous things. And Bernie Sanders emerges from the interview, not just with his dignity intact, but actually looking kind of better because he doesn't really have any patience for this. He doesn't fall for any of the traps. It's one of the few times on that show when Cohen interviews kind of a left or a left of center or even a Democrat affiliated politician. And it's also one of the times on the show where he sort of makes himself the butt of the joke. It's not a particularly mean-spirited interview with Bernie Sanders. I'd be interested in hearing from Cohen why he chose Bernie Sanders of all Democrat-aligned politicians, what his angle on Bernie Sanders was, what he thought he was going to accomplish with that, and why why hasn't he done it with other, like, why hasn't he done it with, like, Chuck Schumer? Maybe he couldn't get an interview with Chuck Schumer, but, like, why nobody else?
He'd get a very different interview out of a kind of centrist Democrat, wouldn't he, if he was able to, if he was able to get an interview. And I mean, I don't know if his method is kind of honed enough for, I mean, this isn't really a criticism of him, but I mean, I don't feel like we've ever really got to see him do the same thing in a mean-spirited way that he, you know, what he did to Rudy Giuliani. I mean, have we ever seen an example of where he does that to like a centrist Democrat or whatever, like a Wall Street Democrat? I don't think we've seen that. So I guess we'll never know. I mean, the other high profile Democratic Socialist interview that he did was with Tony Benn, and Tony Benn fell for it. I mean, he thought that he was being interviewed by some young person that was curious about politics and was a little bit ignorant, but as a result he came off great because he was just very politely correcting the nasty things that Ali G was saying about poor people and the rest of it. And it just gives us a picture of Tony Benn in kind of his later life when he was just this kind of grandfather of the nation, just this very like kindly old respected elder statesman or whatever. Those are the only two examples like that I can think of. And, you know, both the socialists came off looking well, although I haven't seen the Bernie one. I doubt it's very funny. And I never found the Tony Benn one very funny either. It's interesting, but it's not particularly funny.
I think I brought this up a little bit because in Borat 2, there's a scattershot approach to the satiric targets. There are big, high-profile pranks at the expense of big, high-profile people like Mike Pence and Rudy Giuliani. There are also a lot of just kind of more random people, a lot of more local people, people who run bake shops, people who run plastic surgery offices, etc., etc. And if Sacha Baron Cohen were here right now, I think I would be interested in asking him who he thinks the enemy is and why. I mean, he thinks the Republican Party is the enemy. He thinks that conservatism and far-right republicanism is the enemy. But I'm not sure how seriously or how deeply he thinks about it beyond that. Like, obviously he knows that Mike Pence is a bigger target than a bakery shop owner, but they're both in the movie, you know?
Right, right. I mean, I think he also thinks ignorance is the enemy. And I think in the kind of, you know, more cynical reading of some of this, he actually thinks that ignorant people that work at the plastic surgery clinic or whatever are kind of just as worthy targets as, you know, Rudy Giuliani, or at least are worthy targets, maybe not exact equivalents.
I mean, I guess they're not, most of them are not unworthy targets. One of the funniest scenes of the movie is at the debutante ball where he and his daughter, the character of his daughter, played by Maria Bakalova, who's very good in the movie, they go in disguise and they do this hideous mating ritual dance. And, you know, she does it while she's on her period, too. So it has that element of like body horror and everybody's disgusted. And like, I approve of that. I think I approve of that as performance art.
I thought that was an incredible scene. And I also love that he chose that debutante, which it's such a funny ritual because it's like rich Southerners doing cosplay. Like, I don't know the history of debutante balls, but like my guess would be that's like some retrograde 19th century ritual or something that probably people mostly didn't do for a long time, and then they brought it back.
It's very patriarchal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like how they start doing the dance. It's flawlessly executed because they start doing the dance and then all the people are like applauding and they're so into it, and then it just gets like progressively weirder, and then the body of horror element comes in and you can see just people like out of some like misplaced sense of propriety are still kind of like half-assedly clapping for a bit, and then it just descends into just everybody is just silent and they're like looking on in horror. I think I might have seen Newt Gingrich there at one point.
Oh, really?
Am I making that up?
Oh, God. I figure he would have made a bigger deal out of it if Newt Gingrich was there.
I haven't verified this, but...
I want to believe.
My girlfriend said something about Newt Gingrich being there when that scene started, and I was, like, doing some dishes or something, so I didn't catch that that particular frame. That would just make it funnier. But no, I love the idea of, like, Southern aristocrats, like, LARPing, basically. Yeah. That, like, if there was ever a worthy target for just like mockery and humiliation, it would be that.
Yeah.
What did you make of the scene in the synagogue? Because I think to me that was the most uncomfortable scene in the movie, where Borat, dressed in kind of a, well, anti-Semitic caricature, we need say no more about it, goes into the synagogue and he talks to two women and he's who are unbelievably kind and friendly, at least one of whom is an actual Holocaust survivor. And he's denying the Holocaust to her. And then she's saying, no, it did happen. I was there. I saw it. And part of the sort of dramatic conceit behind it is that Borat, who believes that the Holocaust was one of the most glorious moments in Kazakhstan's history, has been led to believe that it didn't actually happen because he's seen misinformation online denying the Holocaust. There's that trope again, online misinformation. And then so he rushes out from the synagogue and he's like celebrating to find out that the Holocaust was real. The actual scene preceding that, I found almost unbearable to watch.
I had the same reaction. I think it's the least funny scene in the movie by a significant margin. Like, I think there are no laughs in it. I think it's not uninteresting. It's a very suspenseful scene, and it's extraordinary to watch the interaction between these two, as you said, incredibly kind and generous women with this man. And I saw at the end of the movie, at the very end of the movie, the film is dedicated to one of them who passed away in the interim between filming and release. So I would be very curious about the construction of the scene, because I believe they probably weren't in on the joke initially, although there are cameras there. So I'm curious about what kind of heads up they got when it was happening. I think the scene is interesting. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure what I think about it. I'm not sure if it's interesting enough to justify how unpleasant it is to watch and what an awkward chord it strikes in the middle of this otherwise very goofy movie.
I should say that it does mirror almost exactly, although it's probably more cringeworthy, but it mirrors almost exactly a scene in the first Borat, which is the one where he goes and stays at that hotel that's run by that elderly Jewish couple, who are very kind and, you know, again, are some of kind of the only sympathetic characters in the movie. And the joke there is that because he's this raging anti-Semite, they're extremely nice to him, and he's still unable to just see it as like regular human behavior, of, you know, regular human kindness. He later sees cockroaches and thinks it's the couple has like transformed into bugs or whatever, and like flees the hotel in the middle of the night. But so it's a very similar scene to that.
It is similar. And I mean, I know that Cohen himself is Jewish and is constantly returning to the subject of anti-Semitism in his work. And he, I'm sure, regards the Holocaust and anti-Semitism with great moral seriousness. There's an effective scene later in the film where he's doing a song at the anti-mask rally, and he does a lyric about we should gas them like the Germans, and it cuts to somebody in the audience doing a Nazi salute, which is a very shocking and chilling moment. You're right that the scene in the church does parallel that scene from the first one, but God, it really is different when a guy is stepping into a church dressed like a Charlie Hebdo drawing, and interacting with Holocaust survivors.
So those two women are, I think, some of the only sympathetic characters in the movie. Another one who you bring up is the African-American woman who Borat leaves his daughter with, who's an incredibly kind and sympathetic person. What do you make of her role in the movie?
You mentioned that she's African-American, which is important to note because race is never a neutral factor in this movie. I think she's used symbolically as kind of a good, ordinary American, you know, the silent majority of good, ordinary Americans who are just trying to go about their business and be good people in crazy times. I think the fact that she is Black is used somewhat strategically.
Well, right, because, I mean, she's a non-reactionary resident in a state where all of the white people he interacts with are just ferociously racist and nasty, right?
Didn't you think it was interesting that even though production of this movie took place during the summer, we see an anti-mask rally, but we don't hear any mention or see any evidence of the protests that dominated the discourse for a lot of the summer? And I'm not quite sure what to make of that. I'm not sure where stuff like that falls in Cohen's worldview. A character like that African-American woman, it's easy for her to be in this movie's liberal imagination because she is what an ordinary person should be in the liberal imagination. She goes about her business. She is a good person. But we don't see the Black Lives Matter protesters because I'm not sure if the liberal imagination quite has space for them. I doubt that Cohen is against them, but I just don't think he knows what to do with them.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine what role they would play in this movie because it's not like he's going to, you know, punk them or whatever. No. But it is striking to see. I mean, I wasn't actually sure when the film was being made until the scene at CPAC, which I guess must date the film to sometime in February or March. And you see Mike Pence kind of, you know, it was that stage when they were basically denying that this was going to be any kind of threat or inconvenience at all.
But also parts of it take place during the summer. And there's even a joke at the end of the movie where in a flashback sequence, Borat meets Tom Hanks in Australia and gives him coronavirus, which, you know, suggests that this movie would have been the production of this movie would have been going on like pretty late. I think the absence for me of those protests, the Black Lives Matter protests and the associated protests, it's just interesting because the movie is otherwise kind of a State of the Union address of America in 2020. It seeks to be this kaleidoscopic vision of America and her problems, but that stuff is conspicuously absent from it. And I get that those protests aren't the stuff of comedy. But the fact that he can't figure out a way to incorporate them somehow, even peripherally, into his vision of America in 2020, I think is symptomatic of a liberal worldview, not a leftist one.
Yeah, and I mean, it's notable and really couldn't be more perfect that this film came out, I mean, less than 2 weeks before the presidential election, an election which, you know, despite Bernie Sanders' noble and nearly successful effort to make it about something else, is essentially now just going to be a referendum. It's like Trump thumbs up or thumbs down. And the negation of Trump as a personality is essentially what's on the ballot next week. I mean, that's what the election is coming down to. And again, I'll just reiterate, I liked this film. I thought it was incredibly funny. I like Sacha Baron Cohen. Nonetheless, inadvertently, I do think it kind of captures the worldview that has become the kind of hegemonic one among kind of the opposition to Trump, the mainstream opposition, which is there are these bad people, ignorance has taken hold, ignorance is in, you know, is in the seat of power, and we have to negate the ignorance and replace it with non-ignorance, you know. We have to take the big bad orange Cheeto president and replace him with somebody who quote-unquote looks like a president and quote-unquote sounds like a president. I have my own thoughts about how successful that will be. And this is getting away from the movie now, but I mean, it's very funny that because of the, you know, unprecedented circumstances surrounding the election, Biden has only had to appear in public really like two or three times, right? Yeah. Which they're not gonna be able to keep doing that when he's president.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that, you know, the libs are going to get their like History Channel president porn and, you know, quite the way that they, you know, they want and expect. Nonetheless, the film captures, you know, I think this ethos heading into the election next week. It is an election which, you know, just brings us back to this eternal recurrence of American politics, where there's a kind of right-wing hegemony. Right now it's Trump. We talked about the Bush era before. Before that, it was Reaganism. And the opposition is never quite able to crystallize, or it doesn't at least succeed in crystallizing into something politically that can actually, you know, attack the right-wing hegemony at its kind of roots and its causes. The cultural imagination of one time or another, the Trump era, the Bush era, really does end up fixating on individuals and personalities and symbolism and aesthetics, and to some extent ignores politics altogether. In 2008, we got the kind of charismatic liberal repudiation of Bush. And I suspect, if the polls are correct, a week or so from today, we're going to get the decidedly non-charismatic repudiation of Donald Trump. And what happens next? I don't know. But for better or for worse, the new Borat film, pretty much the perfect summation of this moment we're in, the kind of what may be the final weeks of the Trump era. Very funny, extremely funny, but unfortunately limited in, I think, all the ways that you were saying.
Very nice. High five.